Well, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, please.
All right.
May it please the court, my name is Matt Adamson. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Leganides, LLC. There's two main issues as I see it on this appeal. The first main issue is, should this court adopt a mortgage exception to the merger doctrine? Second issue, which is somewhat related, is, can you evade a residential use restriction by granting an easement allowing something other than a residential use? With regard to the merger question, there's no question here that the benefited estate and the burdened estate came into single ownership with the 2007 boundary line adjustment. In fact, with the boundary line adjustment, there was only one lot owned by one person. There was only one estate. That was clearly their intent, was to get rid of that easement, vest entire ownership in Prasad, who would then own that area. They did a quit claim deed saying that their intent was to quiet title. At that time, under the authority of Schlager versus Belport, the easement terminated. Under MKKI case, an easement only can exist if there is both a benefited estate and a burdened estate. And here,
once every rule has its exceptions, and the one I'm interested in here, and I'm not quite sure what you mean by a mortgage exception, is whether, under the circumstances of this case, what would be the application of the merger doctrine, as you have explained it, has an exception. And that exception, at least argued by the other side, is that to have allowed merger would have prejudiced a third party. In this case, it happens to be a mortgagee, but it does not necessarily have to be a mortgagee. So why doesn't that exception apply here?
The exception doesn't apply here because this is an equitable doctrine. And under the facts of this case, WT Properties or its predecessor, the lender, who's not a party to this case, are not innocent parties, particularly WT Properties. What we have under the facts here is an easement, which gets into the second issue, but we have an easement that was created that violates a residential use restriction when it was created. Then we have a WT Properties buying the lot at a foreclosure sale and being told at the time that there was a title issue with this area of land and that they would need to get a quitclaim deed for it. They then go and try and get a quitclaim deed for it and fail. They then try and sell the property to my client, who realizes they don't own it, and they WT encourages my client to then go buy that property, which they do, hoping to also buy WT's property. But when that deal falls apart, WT turns around and sues my client, even though they encourage him to buy it, now claiming that they own it.
Well, that doesn't answer my question. That doesn't answer my question. The question here is whether a third party, in this case Viking Bank, who had a security interest in the main property as well as the easement, would have been prejudiced by merger. That's my question. Why wouldn't they have been prejudiced?
Well, they weren't prejudiced in the sense that they got repaid in full.
I'm not talking about repayment. I'm talking about at the time that title and the easement vested in one person. That's the critical time. They had a security interest in that property, a security interest over the easement that went to 170th.
Right.
Under your theory of the case, that would have been extinguished. That would have presumably prejudiced the bank, right?
Well, I don't think it would have prejudiced the bank because they have access off of First Avenue.
Well, and the bank took a security interest to secure what I assume is a commercial loan. Part of that security interest was an access easement.
It was a residential mortgage, but the security...
Whatever.
I understand.
Okay. It was a security interest.
Right.
Under your theory of the case, merger would have resulted in extinguishment of that security interest to the extent of the easement, right?
Correct.
That would have been prejudice, would it not?
I don't... Under the facts of this case, I do not believe it would have prejudiced Viking Bank because they were not allowed to use that lot. Nobody's allowed to use that lot for access, which gets into the second
issue. That's your second issue, assuming you win the second issue. But assuming you don't, would it not be the case that merger of the interests at the time that you argued would have prejudiced the bank by loss of its security interest? Yes or no?
It would have lost its security interest over that easement.
Okay.
But I think it is still an issue of equity to look at the facts of each case as to whether that is appropriate to apply under each case. It's not an automatic application simply because there was a deed of trust there. And I think that you have to look beyond that to the facts of this case.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So we believe that the first issue is governed by Schlager versus Belport, and that they haven't under equity shown here that there would have been prejudice. But I will move on to the second issue, which is the question of whether, one, did the trial court error in finding that this issue wasn't right, and then two, what should the court do if she did? The issue is clearly ripe. You know, if you own a lot and you have a question of whether an easement over your lot, particularly the entire width of your lot, whether that easement is valid, that is a ripe issue for a court. You do not have to wait until the other side tells you how they're going to use your easement before you can pursue a declaratory judgment that that easement's invalid. So the trial court clearly erred in finding the issue wasn't ripe. But secondly, we have the Maybrook plat here, which restricts this lot 17 and the other 17 or 18 lots to residential use only. And the Rush versus Miller case from 1978 saying that it is not a residential use to use a lot for a road to access a subdivision outside the plat. And so Rush v. Miller here says that they could not use this access easement over this lot, and the trial court should have held that. They have an argument here that we can't enforce this against them because they have an easement. Well, I think there's two things there. Number one, that comes from Hollis versus Garwal, this language about it's only enforceable against successors in possession. But we look back at the restatement where that language comes from, and the comments go beyond that language. You don't have to have a possessory interest. And clearly it can't be the law that you can evade a covenant by granting somebody an easement rather than ownership, which gets to the second reason, which is that you can't grant what you don't have a right to do. But this relates to our argument that the easement is really void or invalid, as it was in the Colorado case. Ordinarily, you try and enforce an easement, like in the last case, against somebody who's violating it. Somebody owns it, they're trying to do a use that violates the covenant, and the argument is, does it violate the covenant or not? An interpretation. Here we have a grant of something of a use that's not allowed. If in the Hollis case there was a grant of an easement to excavate rock, that grant would be invalid. Here we have a grant of a right for a non-residential use that's not allowed, and that grant is invalid because the owner who granted it didn't have a right to grant it. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Sean Flynn here on behalf of WT Investments LLC. I'm going to start with...
Why don't you start with the last question that was addressed and whether or not the court's dismissal without prejudice of the claim of violation was... inappropriate or appropriate, I guess.
I wholly believe it's appropriate, Your Honor. And I think the question comes down to how covenants are enforced. Covenants are essentially written promises that run with the land. And here we have one party attempting to enforce a covenant on another party who isn't a member of that covenant. Nowhere do they sign on the dotted line to accept the covenant. You can accept the covenant either by contracting when it's placed, or B, by taking on the piece of property, by owning the piece of property that your predecessor agreed to that promise.
Well, let me suggest something else. There are defenses that you have raised to the enforcement of the covenant, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Those defenses haven't been developed in this current record, have they?
No, not fully, Your Honor. I think...
So at least the trial court dismissing without prejudice held open for later adjudication the question as to whether or not the covenant could in fact be enforced, correct?
I believe so, Your Honor, and what I believe is that there's a distinct possibility that someone else, a member of the there are multiple members of the covenant, right? There are other landowners. Another member of the covenant could come, has the legal right to come and sue Leganese for granting a use in violation of the covenant, but that hasn't happened, in which case my client would be damaged by, if the trial court rules that the by granting the easement it was in violation of the covenant, and thus Leganese shouldn't have done it. It doesn't. It wouldn't. First and foremost, it wouldn't make the grant invalid. My client still was granted something. It wasn't their fault that this person did it in violation of a promise that he made to another person. In this case, then my clients would be damaged, and we would be able to sue Leganese for the value of our grant.
So what you're saying essentially is that this record isn't fully developed with respect to the claim or the defenses surrounding the reservation of this easement, right?
Yeah, what I'm saying is that she left, Judge Mary Roberts left it open insofar as there's a possibility of someone else coming forward and asserting their rights under it.
All right. The other question is whether or not the general rule regarding merger should be applied in this case or whether an exception applies. What's your response to that?
I think the exception clearly applies, Your Honor.
Which one?
Well,
you've argued two.
I've argued the innocent, well, they kind of go together, right? So there's the innocent third party exception.
And we've discussed that, or at least the other side's discussed that.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to know about the Hamlin case then?
Well, you've also asserted that the language in the deed of trust somehow supports your position. Why don't you?
Oh, yes. The language in the deed of trust clearly indicates that the deed of trust would the interest secured by the deed of trust would not be affected by merger. And if you give me a moment, I'll flip to that.
I understand the provision. Why are you entitled to rely on that language between the borrower and lender in that case? There's no argument that you're an intended third-party beneficiary of that.
Well, Your Honor, the question rises is what did my clients buy at the trustee sale? Right, they took everything that the Viking Bank had to give, and if the document didn't allow merger to happen, then my clients acquired the easement at the trustee sale. Because merger is a function of law. You don't have to you don't show up in court and ask for merger. You know, pray for a relief of merger. Merger just happens. Poof. Once you have a servant and a dominant estate coming into the same ownership, unity of title. Where here the deed of trust specifically looks at this and says, look, I don't want my security to be diminished by merger in any way, whether it be having to do with my subrogation rights versus a second party lender, or if the easement were to, say, vanish under law without written consent of the lender first. The appellant went on to make a case of whether that merger is an equitable doctrine in this case. And he goes on to further state that my clients are not innocent third parties in this, right? But I think the appellant misstates who the innocent third party would have been here. The innocent third party would have been Viking Bank at the time that the merger allegedly occurred. In terms of we have a long case law in this state revolving around innocent third parties. The Schlager case goes on to cite the restatement, indicating that there is an exception in many, many jurisdictions. Other jurisdictions have come all the way out and said, hey, we want to, they will label it the mortgagee exemption. Here in this state, we have a long line of case law, which is mentioned in our briefing, that clearly says that merger, there's the general rule, the exception is that the courts will not allow merger to diminish the rights of a third party to said merger. So in almost all the cases that we've cited in both briefs, and coincidentally enough, we rely a lot on each other's cases, that when merger is allowed to occur, you're seeing unity of title, and normally there's not a third party, a mortgagee situation. If you look to all the way back to the Radovich case, it goes on to say that merger cannot, you can't have merger where it abridges the rights of an innocent third party. The Rush v. Miller case was actually a covenant, not a easement, but they're similar. And that's, we can distinguish that here because, oh, yeah, the Rush v. Miller case is interesting in that it goes on to say that the covenant cannot be enforced against only the owner of a property here. So in a strange twist, if Leganese could enforce the covenant against WT, it again would be owning its own parcel. Unless there's any other questions, I'll cede my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. In terms of the ripeness issue, their defenses were presented. We filed a motion for summary judgment. They filed their response arguing the issue wasn't ripe because they hadn't decided yet how they were going to use the access easement. They argued we might not to access an entire subdivision, or we might just use it for a driveway to access a few lots. But either way, under either of those arguments, it's a violation of the residential use restriction. It's not a residential use to use a lot, the entire 41 feet of it, to access property outside the subdivision. The law is clear as to that, and the issue is right. We're not, a property owner is not required to wait around until they decide that they might come up with some other access use. but we're entitled to a decision now as to whether that can be used for that or not, so we know what to do with our property. We're not required to then file a new suit with a new judge and have that judge looking back saying, well, I had a prior judge say it wasn't ripe, and nothing's really changed at this point. And we're of course, not required to wait until they start construction. The Declaratory Judgment Act specifically says in RCW 7.24020 allows for declaratory judgments as to your rights under written instruments. And then we also cited the Dixon versus Case case where the court, without really discussing the issue, but did enter a declaratory judgment interpreting covenants. So we would ask that not only is this issue right, but it's a legal issue for the court to say that they do not have a right, that it does want to use it for access to property outside, and that violates a residential use only restriction. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the calendar for today. The court will be in recess.
Court is in recess.